great service. Good afternoon. Thank you for being here to share your Tuesday afternoon with us. I'm grateful, especially at this hour of the day. This presentation is about evaluating a movement, using systems change outcomes to evaluate environmental policies to reduce asthma risk factors, or as I will call them as we go along, asthma triggers. And you'll see up here a number of my colleagues at both the University of California, San Francisco, and also the California Endowment. And there are no financial relationships to report. Okay, I'm going to go through a very brief description of the CAFA initiative, which stands for Community Action to Fight Asthma, a little bit about the evaluation approach, and some of the outcomes and indicators, policymaker interviews, and analysis. And I'm going to move quickly, but I'm happy to entertain questions after we go through this. So the purpose of this initiative is really to move coalitions into environmental policy work. The California Endowment, in a similar initiative to Allies, not as far-flung nationally, certainly, but had also funded initially some work looking at asthma management. And partway through that program, they realized that they wanted to really move upstream to look at environmental risk factors, because it was great to be able to manage kids, get them on the right treatment, have wraparound services that stabilized kids and their families, but it was a whole nother thing to have the air that they were breathing in better shape and purer. These are the partners, and I'm sorry, the aqua oval down there are the local coalitions. But the reason I really put this up here is because most of the main partners of this initiative are technical assistants. And I think that's a really important part of this initiative. The funder, the statewide coordinating group and their partner in Southern California, the 10 local coalitions, policy, technical assistance, media public assistance, and evaluation technical assistance. And the overall initiative and the coalitions were focused on work in schools, housing, and outdoor air. So we did structured site visits, we did process data, we did outcome data, we did strategic partnership analysis, we talked to policymakers, and we did contextual analyses. And the underpinning assumption of this initiative is that local coalitions can be an engine of change. They can move the gears of policy and beyond policy in additional arenas to create systems change, and that they can do that both from a grassroots up to a treetop level, so that you can do that both in the neighborhood, having a lot of neighborhood involvement and doing things that are relevant to the neighborhood, as well as up to the treetops where you're dealing with policy change. One of the challenges, several of the challenges, building credibility. The overall initiative strongly encouraged use of the precautionary principle and data. Coalitions, however, weren't always familiar with interpretation of environmental, medical, or scientific data. Some coalitions found partners in their local public health department, in local hospitals, with folks on their air resource boards. And another challenge was just finding and garnering continually coalition resources. Additional challenges involved recruiting and managing diverse coalition members and strategic partners at all levels. We started off with 12 coalitions. We finished up with 10 coalitions because a couple of them merged. But we had huge diversity in function, expertise, population. I mean, we had folks all over the state, rural, urban. For example, one of the Central Valley coalitions had within their membership both organic farmers and agribusiness. Think of that as your next planning group and trying to figure out your path forward. We also had businesses in San Diego who joined the local coalition here and came to them because they wanted to oppose a mixed-use new development. They could see that they didn't want housing to be next to some of the industries that were going to be in this industrial park. So it was very interesting. It was not always what we had anticipated our stories would be. Systems change. For us, systems change means understanding the root cause and, in this case, moving towards prevention. And usually for us, systems change means cross-sector change. So we're not looking at change just within the schools or change just within housing or changing just within outdoor air. We're looking at where something crosses over. And we've got the schools working with the housing, working with outdoor air. We looked at changes in awareness and knowledge, changes in organizational behavior, changes in inter-organizational partners, and policy both as a big P and a little P. So if you were working in your local health department and you were working with your public health school, your public schools, and you figured out a way to fund an asthma coordinator who could help implement tools for schools and asthma action plans, that became a policy. And that happened in San Francisco. We literally could not figure out a way to find the funding within the school system. Like everywhere in California, our schools are really, really stretched. But we found a way of routing the money through the public health department and making everybody happy by creating these inter-organizational arrangements. So we count that as policy. Also, we count legislation, regulation, administration, actually a couple of court cases. And also, we look at changes in the arenas where change is sought. That changed over the lifetime of this initiative, as you'll see. So again, if we're looking at health outcomes as the tip of the iceberg here, our assumption is that changes have to happen in all of these below water factors that you see here. And indeed, that did start to happen, or has started to happen. Policy successes at the state level. Actually, the diesel regulation strategies was a statewide policy, and the Long Beach Coalition was a very active leader in helping that to come to fruition across the state. We also used to have this great situation where we would have diesel school buses sitting outside the school, idling, and then those of our schools that had windows that opened would have open windows, so you'd have the buses belching this lovely diesel into the classrooms. We no longer have that, thank goodness. We also have done a lot of work and have a lot more work to do on port pollution. Ports, the trucks that come into the ports, the trains that come into ports, the freeways across our strait are huge, huge issues in our outdoor air. We also have had expansion of citizens' roles in the Air District Board. That's sort of a regional thing because in California, our Air District Boards are regional. But since I only had two slides, it went into the state pot. Local level policy successes. We've had a lot of success educating housing authority personnel about the environmental triggers of asthma. We've had code enforcement that has really stepped up to the plate in public housing, and We have also done things like use the medical record to document the housing connection to unhealthy housing and those asthma triggers for health. We've used data to make the case to public agencies and the County Attorney General's office about the seriousness of the issues. Los Angeles, one of our clinics there, St. John's Wellness Clinic, has taken on slumlords in Los Angeles. Housing is such an important issue that they have formed partnerships with the County Attorney General, the County legal folks who are now prioritizing prosecuting slumlords. It used to be that when you filed a court case in Los Angeles, you came up when you came up. But the folks in the office now understand that there are about 17 families that are the major slumlords in Los Angeles County. And we're not talking about the grandmother who owns a building and has had it forever and isn't quite keeping it up. We're talking about really serious slumlords who own 5 to 15 or 45 buildings who are absolutely not keeping them up to standards. And the legal folks have now started going after those cases and establishing precedents. So the next time those come up, they have something that they can rely upon. Okay, I've got to go quickly here. You'll hear more about this in the future. The Los Angeles and the Long Beach ports import, or through these ports, come a little bit more than 49% of goods that come into this country. Our governor has just vetoed a bill to clean up the ports in California and make them greener. This is an ongoing struggle. It's been going on for at least 3 or 4 years now. It will continue. This is actually an important slide because it shows how people and organizations are starting to organize themselves. When we started out this initiative, we had a number of folks in the lower left who were very organized and very predictable. Most of these were what I call the agency folks, you know, folks whose asthma is their job, and they've been doing it for a long time. They've usually been doing education or clinical management. We also had a number of unorganized, not very predictable players out there who would sometimes align themselves with different opportunities. What started to happen is that there is some self-organizing going on. As organizations have more opportunities, they are starting to cluster around activities, which means the folks down here in the lower left are taking more risks and being engaged in more activities, and the folks in the upper right are getting a little more organized and learning more about their policy skills and the environmental risk factors that everyone else here has referred to. Okay, so starting off looking at schools, housing, and outdoor air, we are now talking about the built environment, land use, and goods movement. And what made that happen? The critical capacities within the coalitions often came down to leadership and this ability to inspire. It also came down to not only finding champions, but having those champions connect with communities so that there was a pipeline created, so that the folks in the communities became very involved and started to learn what they needed to do to really be efficient in this. Adapting to changing situations. It wasn't a given that Los Angeles has evolved into this incredible legal partnership around housing issues. What happened is there was an opportunity. Somebody took that opportunity, spoke to people, and they said, oh, we've only been processing these court cases as they come along. You mean we should be doing something strategic here? And they started doing it. Obviously, the technical skills for policy work at schools that everyone else has alluded to. Just one more thing. Coalitions that had a strong clinical and a community base tended to be more active earlier in this initiative, partly because they've gotten reimbursed for their services. So they had a little more flexibility with funding, although other coalitions caught up quite well. It's important to integrate community members into your data collection, your media use. It will pay off. In our situation, it's paid off in terms of jobs in the community. People are now having to volunteer with the coalition because they have full-time jobs working somewhere else. Special gratitude to the California Endowment and to all of my co-presenters who helped make many of my points and contact information. Thank you very much.
Well, I'd like to thank the presenters who were so gracious to be so timely. And now we have some time for comments or questions. I'd like to open the mic, so to speak. And are there any questions for any of our speakers? Can you hear her without the microphone?
Can you hear me if I talk without the mic?
And repeat the question,
okay,
please.
Okay, well, repeat the question. The question is, did we say much about what the content of the training was? And we didn't say a lot because, again, obviously with the time constraint. So the content of the training, again, building off of the 3-day-long workshops we have at Policy Week, and then we tailored the curriculum to the local context. But we looked at issues about just basically what is policy advocacy? How do you design a campaign, and what are the steps in designing a policy advocacy campaign? Policy Week developed a toolkit for us, and we had the different materials. We'd be glad to share those materials with others, although we're now hoping to develop our own toolkit for training at the neighborhood level, because we found that the training of trainers was at a different level, if you will, than training for youth and in the community context. But what is policy? How is it different from a program? We spent a lot of time talking about the difference between a program and a policy. We, too, talk about policy, capital P, lowercase p, so it could be at the local level, a school board policy, as well as a city policy, regional, state, federal, et cetera. We also did a lot on power mapping, who are your opponents, who are your supporters, who's undecided, why do you do power mapping, how would you use power mapping in trying to bring about policy change, issues on how do you frame your message, a lot on communication, how do you communicate your message to policymakers, to the public. How do you do coalition building, and then
choosing strategies.
So our most recent training was on how do you choose different, you have your campaign, you have your, your overall components, but then how do you choose whether or not to do a petition, or to do a town hall meeting, or to meet with legislators, or do a fact sheet, a variety of different kinds of strategies. What are those strategies, and how do you choose different ones to, again, bring about change?
Yes.
This is actually a question that goes to all of you. I am new to this. I actually just heard your name earlier. I was like, oh, I have to look her up. And here you are. So the work for you is at the individual level and in terms of making decision making to improve treatment outcomes. And what I've been trying to do is to incorporate the layers of contextual complexity that influence the individual, because in medical decision-making, especially in cancer, because the treatments are so complex, they spend a great deal of time trying to educate patients about the risks and benefits, but yet these do not change choices. So it seems that there are other factors, other contextual psychosocial factors. And I was wondering if you could speak to how to bring the larger context that you have so beautifully captured at the community level to begin to look at that assessment at the individual level.
Did you hear the question? It had to do with individual level change and how to, what, does one go about getting some of the contextual factors. And it's open to the panel.
I'll speak to that. I'll stand at the mic because I was the quiet one you guys couldn't hear before. I actually did my dissertation on decision making and the impact on outcomes, and since then have thought a lot about context and how I probably won't have a complete answer for you, but I think basically starting from scratch and looking at the individual, the condition, the factors in their life and their cultural factors that might impact, you know, their decision making, the choices that they have. I mean, it's a lot of factors, basically. But putting together some kind of a model, and it helped me for thinking about my dissertation as well, that actually sort of lays out, you know, that the spectrum. I mean, decision making really starts very, very early for these people, and to kind of lay out the spectrum of decision making for them, and then embed it. For me, it always helps embed it visually. In the way that I did with these other things, bring in the context, bring in and sort of draw out the various pieces that you believe will, you know, impact their it's often a process as well, as people have, you know, subsequent decisions to make as things go along and so forth. So I know I didn't just give you a good pat, easy answer, but I would frame it in you know, start with your either your folks and their issues, and then build your outcomes around that and your and the actual mechanisms that you believe will help drive their considerations for decisions. And then also one of the things that I found, I'm a psychologist by training, a social psychologist by training, and so I was really interested in the impact of making the decision that wasn't necessarily positive, and what kinds of factors would weigh in on how somebody would look back at having made that decision, and so there are a lot of psychological theory that can inform, and even cognitive theory that can inform sort of that whole stream of thought. So you already know about those because it looks like you're a psychologist as well. I'll stop rambling and let anyone else.
My guess is that all of us work in communities because we feel that communities really make a difference in individual behavior. And so the social environment, I mean, when I talk about environment, I'm often talking about physical toxics. But, you know, being aware that there's also the social environment that helps create movements that move people forward. So I don't have an exact answer for you, but I guess I would piggyback and say, you know, start to map out. I mean, there's a ton of decision-making literature out there, but it tends to be a little more abstract, I think, than the kinds of things that we're all working with, where, you know, we know that the level of violence in a community has a very clear impact on the youth within the community and how they do in school and, you know, and probably also with cancer diagnoses and options people seek, energy levels that people have to be able to explore those things. I don't know if that helps, but...
I just wanted to add a little, this isn't an answer, but it made me think of one of the components in most of the coalition's work was community health workers who visited the homes and worked with the child and the family. And a lot of the clinicians said that they interacted with these community health workers and learned a tremendous amount about the realities that those families are facing. And that really helped them customize how they worked with the patients, knowing a little bit more about the reality.
I was going to say, one of the reasons why I think we use a community-based participatory approach is because we ask people who are directly involved in by the intervention what works for them and their folks. So that usually helps to inform better than anything else what needs to be done.
Yes.
Thanks to all of you for your presentations. This question is primarily for Barbara and Angela. You got trained, your folks got trained from PolicyLink, and then you adapted their material, I guess, for the community group. So I have two questions about that. Did some of the community folks help you in that adaptation?
Oh, yes.
And were there any community folks who attended the PolicyLink training? And then the other question I have is, how did you recruit folks to attend? I'm assuming some of them came from people you've been working with for a long time, but then others may have been new.
Actually, the majority of the people who went through the PolicyLink training were community folks. There was probably 10 people from the university who went through the training. Because the URC is a partnership between community folks and academia, we were already engaged and involved in the process in designing the whole training and implementation. So we all went through that training. We recruited other people who were community leaders to assist not only in the development of the curriculum, but actually to do the training as well. So it was really very much heavily led by community folks, because we knew what level our communities were at and what they were ready to hear, and plus that needed to be culturally relevant as well. We could not have done it without the academic support of our academic partners, because they did so much of the day-to-day work and doing the research and bringing a lot of the tools together and putting everything together, and they were up all hours of the day and night doing all of the hard work that those of us who are in the community didn't have time to do.
Was that paid with the community folks who serve as trainers?
Yes.
And I'll speak a little bit to the recruitment piece. Again, this was part of this larger Good Neighborhoods initiative. And the thing we didn't have a lot of time to say, in each of the 6 neighborhoods, there's a community liaison that's a full-time employee through Skillman funding who works with each of those neighborhoods. And for the past 2 years, prior to our getting involved, they have engaged in the community planning process at the grassroots level in each of those 6 neighborhoods. So they have action planning teams and work groups, and they'd already identified what their goals and objectives are for their specific neighborhoods. And then they also had individuals who were attending these meetings and participating at both youth and adults. And so those individuals were absolutely critical, the liaison, in giving us lists of people's names who were part of the action planning teams, part of the G&I effort. We also built on our community partners who had relationships in those neighborhoods. Recruitment—it was a massive, massive undertaking. Still, even with that, to do the recruitment, we went to meetings, we went to events, we handed out flyers, we did emails, we called people, just multiple things to recruit and get folks there. With the youth, the great thing about the youth, Angie's shopping example—they have a really strong youth program already, and so all of the youth who are participants in her youth program participated in the training. And all of this was by design, because we wanted to be training people who were already in an organizational structure that would then allow them to continue to work together and use the training that they received, and rather than just bringing sort of random individuals to the training that then maybe nothing would ever happen to them. So that was a by design kind of issue. But even so, it was still a lot of work.
Had a question in the back?
Community health centers in New York City, Chinatown. And from our previous experience, participating in any type of community capacity or system change kinds of initiative has always been very exhausting, has always been kind of unproductive. And we also have been constantly dealing with funders' demand for quick outcomes, funders' demand for direct.
You're asking about as a CBO? Well, yep. being probably the only person here who's from a CBO, I will attempt to answer that first, is that that is a constant challenge when you're already working in an organization with limited resources that are stretched beyond capacity. It's a constant challenge of how to figure out how to do coalition building, because it is the most time-consuming thing. And it's a cost-benefit analysis that you do many times in trying to figure out what do I participate in, what I don't. One of the things that I have found over the years of working in with coalitions and partnerships is that if we continue to do our work in silos, we are much less effective than working across with many different sectors, and that my work over the past many years as part of the URC has had a lot of tangible and intangible benefits to my organization. One of them is that I'm here presenting at a national conference, and that all the connections that I'm able to make to take back to my community and to my organization. But there are many others that sometimes it's difficult to make a case to your board and to your funders because it's not short term. But in the long term, there really are many benefits that you can take back to your organization, not the least of which is having that connection with researchers who can help strengthen the work that you're doing.
Let me give a perspective of a funder, CDC. And I guess what I would say is, and what I've heard, is that these groups, these efforts, they're able to express what they're trying to accomplish. And that will go a long way towards a funder at least helping them understand that you have thought carefully about what your activities are and what you're hoping. So maybe they're not the ultimate outcomes, but I saw today lots of very careful thinking of what in these activities would do. And I would say that would be compelling, I would imagine, to a board, to a funder, to your coalition, if they want to coalesce around accomplishing something rather than just meeting to feel good.
And just the only other thing I would add to that, I think it is a real challenge, that how do you articulate to a funder that you're not going to reduce health disparities in 5 years. It's not going to happen. You know, I don't care how good your intervention and how strong your policy change is, it didn't take 5 years to create the health disparities that exist in this country. We're not going to undo them in 5 years. I mean, just as an example. So really picking carefully what are the objectives you think you can accomplish in 5 years, and arguing to a funder, you know, in your proposals, this is, you know, here's your overall conceptual model and reduced, you know, health disparities or reduced cardiovascular disease. You know, if you're doing work with youth, how can you measure reduced heart attacks? You're not going to, unless you're going to follow them for 30, 40 years. You know, so you have to have those intermediate outcomes and create that logic model in a really convincing way. And there's so much research evidence out there that shows if you can reduce these stressors, if you can reduce, you know, strengthen these protective factors, you are ultimately going to have an impact on health outcomes. But I think often you're not going to be able to measure that absolute health outcome because of the time frame upon which we get funded. And so it is that kind of real challenge that we're faced with.
Yes.
I have lots of questions, but as a funder, because I work for a foundation, and we fund advocacy, sometimes our grantees don't put all those little details that they went to these meetings and they collected these emails and they spoke to this group, because they just figure, oh, that's just, you know, that's just what I do. They think we're looking for changes in laws. And
just as an example, the youth from my organization who went through the training, just, was it the 18th is when they had the final training, yesterday we're presenting to a group of about 50 policymakers and community leaders on the dropout rate. And that can have an immediate effect of putting more resources into our organization to work on this issue. So there can be a very direct link between advocacy and your day-to-day work.
We have time maybe for another question or two. Yes.
You're going to have to help me here a little bit more. Areas where changes were sought. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. We started off with schools and housing and outdoor air, and those morphed into what are the effects that the Los Angeles, Long Beach, San Diego, Oakland, Richmond ports have on the transportation system in California, and where are schools located close to highways, because we now know that kids whose schools are close to heavy traffic, read diesel, have sometimes lower IQs. Because they're breathing really bad air. I'm making a little bit of a leap, but there is a causal chain. We definitely know that kids whose schools are situated close to freeways have lower lung volume. And we know that more of the schools that are located close to highways in California have more kids from communities of color. And it's hypothesized that one of the disparities that we're seeing in kids in California may well be related to the fact that we are exposing them to too much diesel. So, I'm happy to communicate with you and give you what those studies are. You know, we started off looking at how can we implement tools for schools in our schools. So how can we get the ventilation systems working? How can we encourage teachers to understand what's going on with asthma so they recognize it, get to the environmental triggers, all of that stuff. The coalitions are now taking on, you know, the ports and major transportation systems. The city of Richmond is rerouting their trucks. I don't know how many of you know Richmond, but it is bisected and dissected in all directions by major freeways, and most of those freeways go through communities of color. So the city of Richmond has now taken on rerouting the truck traffic because they want those trucks and that diesel pollution to be further away from communities of color, which is pretty exciting. So that's what I meant by the change of focus and what arena are we looking at. And it's not that the individual components may be different, because a component of the Richmond Transportation Plan is still where the schools are located. But it's just we're looking at a larger part of the picture. Thank you for asking the question.
Other questions?
I have one. Some of what you guys talked about is related to quality of life and measuring the outcome. And so how do you measure it?
The question is, how do you measure quality of life as an outcome?
Well, we use any number for, can people hear me? For, depending on the program, we use any number of measures. We usually use the SF-12 or one of the SF.
SF-12.
Okay.
The RAN
short form health status measure, it's put out by Quality Metric now, and it's a, I can, if you give me your contact information, I could, and it's very well validated in a lot of different countries and a lot of different diseases, and they have a lot of information out there. Sorry, I didn't mean to look at you.
That's
but
okay.
That was helpful.
Great.
But
yeah.
But then there are also, depending on their disease specific quality measures, there's a actually a very, very thick measure of all kinds of quality of life measures, eye disease, and you name it, they're out there.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, the book that I have on it is so heavy, it's not,
yeah.
It's almost not movable.
Yeah. Other questions? Yes.
There is a pretty strong advocacy network. So coalition members, and which may well be community residents, travel to Sacramento to testify. Specific legislators also call upon certain coalitions and their members when they are drafting legislation. One of the strengths of this coalition network is that it covers much of the state, and it has very, very diverse groups who are members. So sometimes legislators or aides will call up and say, hi, we're thinking about this or this or this, and we want to know if you're willing to support this and if you're willing to talk to your other community coalition members across the state. It's also important to note that this is now the 7th year of this initiative. So this stuff did not happen overnight. This, talking about community efforts and the amount of capacity it takes to keep this going. I don't want to minimize any of that. So I should have said that earlier, but this is definitely year 7. And it's taken that long.
I noticed that we are out of time, so could we perhaps ask if you had another question, would you see a speaker individually? And I'd like to thank the speaker.
Thank you. You'll be wishing you didn't give me your phone.
have like a surveillance system for, you know, quality of life necessarily. So, but it's important to think about in terms of outcomes.
Thank you.
research. So do you feel that you're in the back of the research? I mean, do you have to follow, is there a general part of what you guys
right.
Oh, shoot. I've lost it again already.
Well, here it is.
Oh, thank you. It's the advantage of having a Timex.
Thank you very much.
Sorry,
Seattle's my home. Yeah. And for personal reasons, I needed to go back to Seattle after I finished my coursework. And so I decided, and because I work collaboratively, and you know, sociology, they still have that lone sociologist model, and I'm from public health, and I don't work that way. So I made a decision that I was going to try to find a research group up in Seattle, and I've been long associated with the University of Washington. But I keep leaving the University of Washington also because, you know, I go to the University of Michigan because my focus is a little different. They're much more, they're, you know, in some ways they're very similar to UCSF, I think, in terms of, you know, health services, research and stuff. So I am in the Department of Health Services at UW. But I was, so I went back and I was very fortunate to be working with Community Campus Partnerships for health. And, trying to figure out my dissertation, and I was invited to join this project to kind of see if my dissertation, if I could squeeze something out of it. They're actually looking.